special treat today because we've got a man called Roger Grave, and Roger stands behind essentially a new movement in documentary making in this country and possibly in the Western world. But his career is a long and distinguished one, and he is American, but has lived in this country for much of his adult life.
And now British.
Indeed, he's got an order of the British Empire. The British Empire lives on only in medals. The films which he did, which are typically documentaries, were of a new kind called Fly on the Wall. They were a question of the filmmakers getting into a particular milieu or environment, like, say, police service, which was one of the famous ones he did, or some other, and making a documentary which reflected the inner life of organizations and the way in which people interacted with each other. Now, in various forms, rather common. But he began, he was the pioneer, and he still is, because he still makes some tremendous films. Indeed, he said he's doing 10 films at the moment, which is a low workload for him. We're very happy he's had time to come in here and talk to us. And then some of you may remember that Alex Connor of Ten Alps talked to us some months ago, and Alex's company owns Roger's company.
He's my boss.
So he's the boss.
I own Roger.
So he's here to look to say he doesn't see anything embarrassing.
Exactly.
And then Alex will come back. Back on Roger and ask him about his profit and loss account after Roger's finished. So Roger, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure, John, and I'm very glad to be here and welcome all of you. It's an interesting challenge to talk to people whose experiences are so different as yours are, because I can't take for granted that the things that I've done would be possible where you all are. And indeed, I've done this kind of talk, for example, in Ireland and in Australia and in Italy, and so somebody here from ABC, yes? Who's that?
Yeah.
Right. Hi. We've worked with ABC, as you may or may not be aware. And when I was talking to the filmmakers in Australia, they just said, if only. I mean, ABC is pretty good, and SBS at the time was another partner. But the number of opportunities we have here, even though people complain about the budgets and slots, is enormous compared to most other channels. And we just finished a film on 50 years of amnesty with the Dutch and the Germans as direct co-production partners and 11 other partners in pre-buys and so on. And we were looking at the way the viewing patterns of this film about 50 years of amnesty were in Germany and in Holland and here. And they were bad in all three countries, which was quite interesting. And we were trying to figure out why. And I said, well, when did you show it? And she said, well, I got a special dispensation from the schedule to show it at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. Right? Because otherwise it would have been at 11:30. And 11:30 is the normal slot on Dutch television for documentaries. The normal slot. And I said, why on earth are you taking, showing films at 11:30 at night? People go to sleep. On a Friday night, they're out getting drunk. They are not going to watch a film about 50 years of amnesty. It's hard to imagine a viewer that would, And she said, well, it was that or nothing. Right? So, and this is Dutch public television. So if you think about the two questions that are obviously real for me, one is getting the commission and the money to make the films that we make, and then getting people to watch them, which is the topic of this seminar, making serious films for mass audience. It's actually, I hate to say it, and it's not really true, but it's actually easier to get the commissions than to get the audience. And it's quite an interesting contradiction, that, because in one respect, once you've got the film there, and it's, with YouTube and so on, it's possible to imagine what's called a long tail in new media speak, which means that the film is around and seen many times. And when that works, it's terrific. And one of the films we made, and I will show you just a clip because it's so much fun, is called Requiem for Detroit. Have you seen it? How many people have seen that?
And
you saw it?
Yes.
You saw it. Okay, let's just show them a little clip of this. But
I haven't got it. It's on the other disc. However,
no, it's on there. Yeah, fine.
However, I need to get your other disc out. Sorry, I didn't know we were doing it.
No. Isn't it online?
On YouTube? Oh, is it there?
I don't know. We may not.
No, we've got it on the. Sorry, excuse me, everybody. I didn't know we were doing that one.
Well,
that would be on the hop. It'll be in the secret area.
No, that's because.
Keep talking for a minute, and I'll find it.
I see the secret area.
Keep talking for a minute.
Okay, all right. Now, the point about this example.
A lot more, honestly.
The reason I'm mentioning it isn't just that it's about America, but Detroit. One of the problems I've got is just getting people to care about other countries. I mean, it's just a problem in this very provincial, sophisticated culture of us. But Detroit was the center of most of the news coverage of the last. The year before last, when it looked like GM was going to go bankrupt. Right? They actually were on the verge of bankruptcy, and it would take down America's fourth largest city. So I said, this is really interesting. Let's make a film that isn't just about the news, just extended part of the news. Thanks. But just hold on for a second.
Yep.
And so what we pitched was a kind of mixed media, multicultural approach, because there's a music in Detroit, and there's, you know, Detroit's significance in design, and well, I mean, the car is the centerpiece of American culture and so on. And it didn't fit a category. So we ended up, and I'm just telling you this because you're professionals and you need to know how this process works. I pitched it in November. By January, I was told, we love it, it's absolutely fantastic, we want to do it. And every day the news was Detroit. But by March, no, I still didn't have the money, I still didn't have the go-ahead, and I saw the controller of BBC Two walking down a hall, and she's rather distinctive even from behind, and I just pushed her up against the wall and said, are we going to do this before Detroit can now explode? And she just went, okay, right? Now, that was Detroit, you know, that wasn't Addis Ababa or some rather more, you know, that's kind of central in people's minds. So it took me 4 months to get this film commissioned, and they gave me about two-thirds of what they'd originally promised. And the cost of the archive was so expensive, we had to replace 30% of it in the last week before transmission. But I'll show you just a little clip from this to give you a sense of the excitement, and you'll see the reason why I'm mentioning it.
It's the opening, basically.
Okay, now what I'm doing is I'm looking up on Twitter the last the last tweet. It was shown in March of 2010. The last tweet was 22 hours ago. Right? Tempted by Detroit, wild city, but will it live up to Requiem for Detroit? Right? Yesterday. And every time I do this, there's a recent. Yeah, so talk about a long tail. You know, that's 18 months with people still discussing it. It's still in their minds. It's been pirated about four times and put up on YouTube and then taken down by the BBC, who just don't like that at all. But I don't personally mind, you know, because I just want people to watch it. But the dialogue, the conversation about that film is still going on, you know. Well, it's near. It was last March, wasn't it? Yeah.
It's about a year and a half ago.
So, in a way, what I'm getting at is that, you know, the audience on Twitter that is keeping the conversation going is much larger than the 2 million people or whatever it was, 1.8 million people that did finally watch it. And, you know, the BBC didn't understand what we had and what we'd given them. And it was just hell on wheels getting it there. But here we are in conversation with people all over the world. But which has got nothing to do with me, right? I'm not controlling this at all, other than occasionally with the stuff going up and going down. Now, that part of the point of this is to say that the idea that you have to dumb down or, you know, simplify your stuff in order to reach mass audiences is actually not one that I subscribe to. What I think you have to do is be alert and aware of spaces in the conversation, in the national conversation, in the international conversation, which you can occupy and can present in an interesting way. Unfortunately, we don't have a clip of something which I'm going to tell you about, but since my colleague from ABC is here, I'll just mention it. It's a film you might have seen that we made actually with SBS, but I'll just tell you how it got commissioned and what it did. There were riots 5 years ago in Cronulla.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah,
4 years ago, between Muslims who lived nearby and who were coming out to the beach, and white Australians who used radio to convene a sort of riot against what was allegedly a rape by two or three Muslim teenagers of a white girl. And I was there for a retrospective a year later and said, well, whatever happened about that? How are these people working together now? Or what's the aftermath? And somebody said to me, look, what they're doing is a Muslim girl, a preacher, an imam, has had this brilliant idea of creating Muslim lifesavers who would then enter the Australian culture and be accepted. And I said, there is a brilliant film. You know, because it's so hard to get films about Islam. I made the first film about Islam in the West, to get that on in a neutral and interesting way, where, you know, terrorism has become a sort of brand of any conversation about Islam, and it's very hard to have it. So I just said, fine, we'll do it. And the commissioning editor was standing right next to me and said, right, you're on, would you do it? And it took about 40 seconds to get the commission. And then Nick Fraser and the BBC took it on as a storyboard. So we showed it both there and in Australia, and I'm very pleased and interested in that film. However, the category, and this is what I want to talk to you about as well, the category of a film about Muslim lifesavers, you know, doesn't fit any kind of obvious thing. Is it a documentary? Yes. But it's got this religious overtone? Yes. It's multi-faith stuff? Yes. And the part of the problem in reaching audiences again is getting a slot that can, right, like the Dutch experience. Right? So in the list of all these films, I'm always trying to go for the biggest channel, biggest audience, 9 o'clock. As Alex said to you a month ago, we're in show business. Now, I'm not making these films for me and my friends. I really want people to understand it, and especially in that Australian film, the power and potential of it. But again, it's not easy. I proposed to SBS, who had other films, and it's part of their remit to do multi-faith, multicultural stuff, that they create an online forum for all the people who've been at these riots to compare their own experiences online, which I thought was a really nifty multi-platform idea to attach to our film. And they said, yeah, and didn't, because they didn't get the power of it. But part of what I'd like Alex to chip in on, in my view, is that the real way to reach large audiences now isn't just through television and showing the stuff or through articles, but creating this sort of dialogue online that sustains whatever it was you were trying to get across. And one of the problems, which again, you're print journalists, you don't quite have it, but it's still true, is that people will read the first 3 paragraphs and then they'll skip. So they'll be interrupted, right? Or whatever. I mean, the idea that we work very hard on our last conclusion, concluding paragraphs, and subs kill them, you know, just before you go to print because they need an ad that has to go in, and, you know, your beautiful prose suddenly turns into, you know, sort of shorthand. And the same thing happens to us. And so, you know, a lot of these films, which are really well argued, I mean, Oxford is a very interesting place to be talking about this, because the kind of interaction with the material that you go for in university, where you really interrogate whatever it is that you're presented with, doesn't happen on television. But it can happen now that you can play it again, now that you can have an iPod, or, you know, a download podcast, things like that. And suddenly, that's a change. So what I'm getting at is something rather subtle, and I hope if you're not a first language English speaker that it's clear, because if it isn't, say, and I'll make it clear. Television films are made in the daytime and watched by commissioning editors in the daytime from beginning to end. Television is consumed largely in the evening and interrupted all the time, and, you know, you cannot assume that people are seeing it from the beginning. And therefore, the nature of that communication interaction is completely contradictory. It is designed with enormous care and then consumed erratically, if at all. Yeah? Yes, Derek.
I'm just asking one question. So much of the television I watch is recorded stuff, which I watch later, which does make it possible to go through. Do we have any knowledge about the live audience versus the recorded audience?
Yes, we absolutely do, and it's growing. I mean, the iPod, what's it called? iPlayer. The iPlayer is, the consumption is growing. And there is something called, what's it? It's not on the BBC archive thing, but they're now planning to try and put, to extend the life of the programs on iPlayer so that it'll be more accessible. And I'm absolutely for that. But the degree to which we can count on it is unpredictable.
You can also extend the life of a program forward, which is quite interesting. As if it just as it happens, just that this film here that Roger did a couple of weeks ago, Amnesty, we got best part of 4,000 views on the film before it ever went out.
Yes.
By running essentially a Twitter campaign using all the Amnesty hashtags. And I think if we'd been more systematic about it, we could have made that 40,000, not 4,000. And they would have been thought leaders. So actually, you can make the sort of graph like this, just like that.
Ordinary people who believe.
Thank you, Alex. I hope that engages you and that you want to watch it, and I'll send you guys a copy, David, and you can watch it here. Yes, sure. Yeah,
so
of course.
On YouTube prior to it.
Yes, thanks.
We tried an experiment and it was just an experiment, and we didn't do it brilliantly, I don't think. But we knew that we knew that Roger's colleague James had made a great film, and we knew that it had Amnesty International in it, so we just went on Twitter and just found every Amnesty hashtag and just tweeted it in every possible way, using that chaser tape. I don't know whether anybody's from the TV business here. Anyone who is from the TV business here, you're the guy from Australia.
There's about three people from.
Yeah, well, no. The key commodity now in selling TV programs and indeed getting people to watch them is what they call a sizzler or a taster tape, and everything we've showed you so far today was essentially a taster tape.
Oh, so it was just a teaser.
Yeah, so we just took the teaser up, and I think actually that's a really crafty way to build the brand. These are brands, if you think about them, but to build the brand of that show is to stick it on YouTube, tweet it like crazy. And I think if we'd done a better job, we could have done it next time. I'm going to do a much better job. I know how to do it now.
Well, that's what Hollywood does very well.
Yeah. And the key with Twitter is to actually enter other people's conversations forcibly by using all the hashtags they're using. And, you know, and then but to get people to watch it. And actually, that's even more important than getting people to watch it afterwards. Because what you also want to do is want to raise its profile. Because it's all too easy for a program to kind of go out and no one to notice it. In the same way that I've noticed that people often launch websites and think that the day they've launched their website, they've somehow done their job. When in fact their job has not even begun yet. Just by launching a website, you've achieved nothing. It's by making people log onto your website that you achieve something. You know. So, and I think just before you guys came in, we were saying that ultimately we're in show business. And ultimately show business, and so are journalists actually to a degree, but ultimately, you know, you have to make people want to consume your product. However much you might not like that language, that's what you've got to do, actually. You know.
And it's such a noisy environment now. I mean, it seems to me, much harder now, and most people are going to watch, not most as a general, you probably know, but I mean there more and more people are watching television, certainly under 30, on their computers, and they're on their computers doing other things while they're watching. Now some of that is a resource, okay? Another clip I want to show you is a film that we're very, very proud of and doing a sequel to. And I'll tell you, I mean, the twittering, this is Kids in Care.
Yeah.
The twittering started, the tweeting started in Detroit about 3 minutes into the film with people saying, oh my God, you know, do you see this stuff? And people in Detroit tweeting back, saying, when can I watch this? Well, you know, it was only being shown on BBC. So we had this international conversation, immediate, right through the film. And I kept watching the film going on and seeing all these people who were supposed notionally watching, who were tweeting all the time. And so you have to say, well, what kind of engagement with the film is there if this tweeting is going on the whole time, okay? Now, here's a film that is very interesting about the Twitter conversation about this.
I get full screen, sorry.
Okay. Now, well, I can't find the tweets of this to read to you, but it was last October. And the really interesting thing is, this is a difficult film. Well, it's a serious. I mean, it doesn't get much more serious than Kids in Care. And we were at BBC One, 9 o'clock, and it won it was the most watched program at 9 o'clock. It beat a reality show on ITV and whatever else was on the other channels. But the thing that fascinated me was the Twitter conversation that started 5 minutes in again. And what was happening, what people said was one of three things. I can't watch it, it's too painful. There was quite a lot of that. Then there was, oh my God, you know, how did these children get there? In fact, there was also a stream of people who had been in care, which I thought was very interesting, that who just felt that they were being honored, if you like, or respected by having attention paid to them. And the third were people saying, I want to foster these children or adopt. And again, hundreds approached Coventry where we did this, and thousands, you know, were writing in the next day. So another dimension to this conversation, which I want to raise with you, is the quality of attention that you get for the work that you present, whether it's an article or a film. Because there is a difference between just what they call eyeballs on the screen or bums on seats, and the something else which is called the Audience Appreciation Index, the AI, which the BBC uses, and now I gather Channel 4 is going to start to use, which is to rate, people actually put numbers attached to how well made was it, how memorable was it, did it affect you, did you feel, you know, I mean, it sort of breaks down the response that people have to the work in a much more sophisticated way, and I like that, I have to say, because it just doesn't tell you anything, to just give you the numbers. Because people may be making love or cooking dinner or being on the phone while the set is on, and it doesn't tell you anything. But the thing that we do, which I'm most proud of across 30 years of Films of Record and before, is this. We put hard questions on television, mainstream television, and we don't answer them. Whereas the traditional form of filmmaking, documentaries and so on, is to try and give people at least a false sense of conclusion. I mean, they don't mean to be false, but they just kind of force a conclusion. And what the films I've made as a director and the ones I've been producing, they leave you with questions. Should amnesty, you know, what is the role of amnesty in the next 50 years? You know, is there ever going to be a moment when they are all free, which is this wonderful line that Peter Benison's colleague said to him. You know, in the first year after they managed to get people out of Ghana and Portuguese jails and so on, they said, well, what are we going to do when they're all free? If only. So we even put the question in the title. And that idea of leaving questions open is really quite radical in television terms, as you may already know. And for me, I'm quite inspired by a quote from Franz Kafka, the novelist, who says that the job of fiction is to put an ice pick in the brain. And I see that as the job of our films, so that people are remaining with a question that is unanswered. It doesn't have that sense of closure. And the people I'm most complimented by, sort of flattered by what people say about my films, is they say, we switched off and had an argument. Not that we agree, but that, you know, my wife, how could she possibly agree with, you know, those kids are useless, they should all be shot at dawn or something. You know, but that's what we want, is we want people to engage and to argue.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sure, of course, yes, this is a conversation.
Yeah. You muted the F words, you used the beep sound. So don't you think you compromise something of the context when you don't allow the kids speak as they do and they use a lot of F words? So.
We didn't beep them later. It was because that was shown right off the 9 o'clock news, which is called the watershed in this country. You're not allowed to swear before 9 o'clock. And the gods at the BBC called compliance, editorial compliance, who run the BBC really, said we had to bleep it. I quite agree with you. But later in the film, when they swear, they don't, it's, you hear it. I think. I can't remember if we succeeded in keeping that, but that was the idea. No, no, I agree. Couldn't agree more.
Of course. You were bleeping as well. You said that word.
Yeah, because I had understood that when I was.
You're absolutely right. BBC.
Yeah, so we are obeying the BBC rule here. Yeah.
Came from this time on.
Yeah, so I tried to behave.
But, you know? I mean, James, you will agree.
I agree. I think you should not be.
bit harder.
No, but I mean, we had to. There wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't exactly a conversation, to be honest. I mean, these idiots come. But see, that's the.
India is a TV reporter from India.
Yes, right.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you the three clips which we saw. One was Ted Prowett, the other was Amnesty International, and the third one was Kids in Care in UK. So these are essentially places which are central to the Western mainstream. So how difficult it is to make films on places which do not belong to the mainstream?
That's a very good question. Can you show the Troubled Pirates clips, please?
That's a perfect cue. Yeah.
It is.
That's a good question.
But only 59 views. It's not enough.
Well, that's because we haven't promoted it. It's probably...
No, you're right, of course.
Let's play it off here because it's not working on it for some reason. Do you know which one you want?
Well, let's start with the first one. It's not working on YouTube.
For some reason, it'll just be connection.
Under pressure on land, the pirate attacks become ever more unpredictable at sea.
On
Saturday, April 4th, 2009, the Tannet was making slow progress south in the...
There's no chance of doing it, because YouTube has the first 3 minutes.
Oh, let's give it a shot.
I'll just tell you what it is anyway, to answer the question. I was very interested, and this is the story is quite a good, interesting kind of journalistic task, okay? A friend of mine happens to be in the shipping
business.
Sorry, here we are. This is the game. Can you just pause for a second? I'll introduce it anyway, now that I've started. This guy is in the shipping business, and he told me that when the 2008-2009 crisis happened, ships all over the world were just frozen offshore in major ports because the banks wouldn't fund the bill of lading, it's called, which is the forward, you know, to pay for the cargo in advance, to lend the money for the cargo when it's landed and so on. So this was, I thought, a terrific story. But to make it on television, all these ships doing nothing, was beyond my, you know, capacity to think of a way to do that. However, the Somali pirates were also doing this, interfering with shipping and so on. And we said, well, okay, let's make a film about the pirates. Because I went to see shipping lawyers and this kind of thing. And we acquired, we got the commission out of Nick Fraser and the Swedes and the Germans. And it was called The Trouble of the Pirates, and, you know, this was great. And so Somalia, which is not a country that normally enters people's consciousness, but did once the pirates started really getting into business there. We had this film, fantastic, right? So we had, but the proposition was we would film with the Navy and see how they dealt with it. We'd try and film with the pirates, we'd get into Somalia, and we'd film with a lawyer doing a negotiation, okay? We got the money, we did the filming. The lawyer wouldn't agree to be filmed with live negotiations because his clients wouldn't agree. The Swedish-Somali guy we sent, trained up as a filmmaker, went to Somalia, never saw a pirate in action at all because they'd always just left. Whenever he got to a town, they'd just left. And the Navy was out on the sea forever and never saw a pirate either, okay? So we then have this problem. We have a commission, we have three broadcasters waiting for a film in which all the things that we promised are not there. Now, if you're all journalists, what would you do in a situation like that? Any thoughts? Because I'll tell you what we did.
Dress up as pirates.
That's a very good answer. But yeah? You've got any thoughts? What would you do?
I assume that what you've done is you've gone to find you've gone for the emotional aspect of it, which is the families waiting for the people.
No. Actually, it's a very good idea. But do you know how long the coast of Somalia is, by chance? Does anybody know how long the coast of Somalia is?
About 3,000.
Yeah, 3,000 kilometers. Exactly. It is from Maine to Florida, the same distance. Somalia alone, yes. Isn't that amazing? But anyway, that was part of what we were learning. What we did was this, and I'm quite sort of chuffed that we managed to do it. We said, if we can't see them doing what it is they're doing, let's see the damage that they do. Let's infer the impact of what they do, both inside Somalia. And so the lawyers talk about it very eloquently. We have little snippets of negotiation without knowing what the boat is. We went around Somalia with this guy, seeing there are 5 million refugees, some huge number of refugees, internal refugees, because of the damage and the uncertainty inside the country. And we went on the Navy, and the Swedish guy, the Admiral, and his team were really eloquent about the pointlessness. And just again, this is something which won't be in this clip, but they've got 7 ships or 8 ships, the EU created a Navy, and they are policing 1.5 million square miles, right? With 7 ships, slow moving, not a great prospect. But that's the point. As we start, the film becomes much more interesting as a layered series of stories about futility and frustration. And the lawyer makes the point very clearly, every time they pay a ransom and release the people, that story, the French story, is actually about the one person killed, and they're killed by the French in the rescue. And because Sarkozy was going to posture himself, you know, as this tough guy. So there's an emotional, personal story, there is. There's the economic story where they say, it costs us more to leave them as hostages than to pay for them and get them out. But every time they do that, it pushes the price up, right? Very, very interesting dilemma, politically, geopolitically, okay? And the Navy is saying, well, we've got to try, but we've got 7 ships on a million. And every time they succeed, they push the pirates further out. So they go into the Indian Ocean now, right? From, they go really 700 nautical miles, this kind of stuff. So it's a series of conundrums. Right? And it's a much more interesting film than if we had an action film of the pirates in action. And the last shot in the whole film is a wonderful pirate who's sort of 6'4", very long legs, who just says, guys, if you're not going to fix our country, we're coming after you. Right? And you'd, so that's what I mean by an open question, because you're left with the image of the politics of the country.
But also, you wanted to ask, sorry.
No, I mean, does that... I'll show you the clip, if you don't mind, and then we'll carry on. Because I just wanted to give you a sense of how we penetrated a world, a space that was not occupied or not in the Western thing. And then we can... Let's just show you, because it's a nice clip as well. Footage we got, of course, was mobile phone footage from people who'd been kidnapped, right? The woman, the French woman, gave us her rights to the home movie footage they took on their ship, when she refused everybody else. But because we were opening up the problem, and she ends up saying, if I, in Brittany, somebody, you know, was a pirate, somebody took my fishing the way we took their fishing, she said, I would seize boats. She says this herself, you know, she's wonderful. So I'm incredibly proud of the film, and I'm going to leave it with David for you guys, for the whole film, because I think it's a very interesting example of how to solve a number of journalistic problems. And I hope you get to see the whole thing, because it's really, really interesting film. But selling it, because of this difficulty, was hard. Yeah, what's the rest of your question?
The question was that when you're making a serious film, or when you're making a film like this, are you thinking of your audience, or you're not thinking of your audience?
I'm always thinking of the audience. Absolutely always. But I'm part of the audience. Alex and the colleagues in the company are part of the audience. I mean, I don't make a distinction. I'm really interested in what anybody thinks, and if they don't understand it, we change it. Because the point of it is to put the ice pick in the brain. Right? And that we want anyone who sees this film, and I'm not joking because this is what happens with our successful film, next time they read an article about Somalia or about pirates or about shipping or about I don't know what, they'll think of that film. We did some shooting. We've got access to something called the Gangmasters Licensing Authority, which helps try and protect the working conditions of migrant workers. And they're ex-cops. And it's something nobody's ever heard of, but then there's in danger of closing down. So they've offered us access. And then we went on a raid with them yesterday. And the filmmaker who made this film and the Amnesty film was shooting it. I said, how did it go? He said, I have to say, it's the most polite arrest I've ever filmed a witness. And because these people recognize that they're in a no-win situation, when they help rescue these workers, the border agency throws them out of the country. It also puts the price of onions up, because they're picking onions and nobody else wants to do for the price that they get paid. And the police don't want to know, because the jury say they're migrant workers, who cares? So they have poor conditions, what else do they expect? And this is really interesting, they just, a £5 million trial was thrown out in Merseyside by the jury, who just said that. the migrant workers. Why do we care? And so the police don't want to go there. The border agency wants to throw them out. And these are a bunch of ex-cops who want to try and this. So I'm going to play with the stereotype of a police show, right? With lots of action. And instead you have these rather polite people saying, I wonder, you know, Mr. Farmer, could you come with us? Oh, okay. And so it's the exact opposite. But this, you have to play with the stereotype in order to even get the conversation going. You understand? We play a lot of games with that. I mean, for example, the most successful film I was ever involved in was called The Secret Policeman's Ball for Amnesty. It's still selling on DVD. Monty Python and Beyond the Fringe, all these great comedians. But we made it as a documentary. We were backstage, we were with them, it's handheld, it's completely the opposite of comedy on television. And that gave it a kind of immediacy. And you know, you feel like you're really there rather than watching something that you sit back and consume. So people, they always remember that. The parrot sketch and the four Yorkshiremen and so on are in everybody's language, not because of Monty Python only, but also because of our film. So that's, we're playing all the time with whatever we can borrow. I mean, I don't know if it's, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to say
more questions.
Maybe Alex should,
yes, sure.
Should
yes.
Intervene and come back on it, then we can all
sure.
No, no, I'm just here to listen. I think we should watch another clip. I think you should look at the Great Ormond Street one, because that's another dimension that we haven't talked about, which okay. is appallingly tough and horrible editorial decisions that you have to take and
sure.
resourcing okay. and, you know, so to me.
Yes, I do, but actually, just if you don't mind, the clip I was going to suggest we see was the Murder Mansion.
Oh, okay.
Because that, yeah. what this is a very tabloid story, which we dealt with in a non-tabloid way. So this was a very big story, huge story, but, and so we had to get people's attention in the first 2 minutes, but then I'll tell you what we did with it that was different, okay? And then we'll go to Great Ormond Street, please. Now, that looks like a real, you know, mass audience, 9 o'clock, blah, blah, blah. But what happens in the film, which you don't expect, is that these cops and the parent, the mother and the brother all talk, and so his best friend also talks. And they talk at quite considerable length, and they talk very intimately, and they talk very, very quietly. And so by television standards, they're not, you know, all that excitement just slows down immediately. And you get involved in the question of what it's like if your son kills himself and his family. And the mother actually says on camera, you know, no matter what he's done, he's still my son and I love him. And that's near the end of the film, at the very end. And, you know, because it raises a really serious moral dilemma about that kind of thing and how you deal with it and how you deal with the unbelievable, you know, which is what this is. So we took a tabloid story and went much deeper with it, but we said, okay, you know, you want some excitement, it's exciting. Now pay attention, okay? That we just needed to get them in and then, it's a good film, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's true. Now, in the Great Ormond Street stuff that Alex mentioned, this is a series. How many people have seen Great Ormond Street? That was on BBC Two. Nobody. Well, 2.7 million people watched for 3 nights from it, three weeks. And they've been making 6 more now. And in this country, at least, I don't know about India or other countries, but children's hospital films are very popular, very, very, very popular. But no children ever die. The nurses are wonderful, the doctors are brilliant, and the children always recover. In Australia, I imagine that's the same, yeah?
Sometimes they die.
Sometimes they do die. Well, it's a convention in the British ones, they don't. So what we did was we approached them and said, we want your most difficult cases. We want the ones where you don't know what to do, whether you don't know whether they're going to live or die. And then we're given access to film these incredibly painful discussions about children who would have died already, except for medical science keeping them alive. And then there's the question of, is it right to operate on children whose quality of life, if they lived, is very uncertain, and they may die and go through a lot of pain in the process. And so there's no right answer, is what I'm saying. You know, for hard questions, this is a really good example of that.
Sorry.
Very well. also a couple more on the clip.
Oh, are there? Let's go with that.
Well, you get a flavour of that. I mean, there are other clips, but I think that's just the beginning. First 2 minutes again, the scenes go on for quite a long time as they debate whether they should or shouldn't do this stuff. And it held its audience. 2.7 million is a lot of people by television standards. And they came back, they came back again. And in this film, I think 4 children die, in intensive care, 5 children die. And in the kidney film, 1 child dies. But it's clearly a relief, and the parents agree to it. And one of the doctors wants to give her a heart, lung, and kidney transplant. And you just think, right? But they have a major discussion about, you know, this is a child who's never spoken, and maybe over years, and they want to do that. So that's what I mean about hard questions, yeah? We're just saying, this is the real world. Nobody knows answers to things like this, but they're struggling, and we think that's a good thing to do, not to support the illusion that doctors always know best. It's not good for them either.
But should we pause there?
Yeah.
Maybe you might want to throw more clips later.
No, fine.
Just bring everybody in.
Absolutely.
I'm sure
lots sorry, of questions.
Not at all. That's been, yes, it's been completely fascinating. One thing that you mentioned, that I'm just to start the ball rolling, if I may, the quality of attention index. Mm. One thing that strikes me when you were talking about the response you're getting from Twitter and from the other sources as well, is that people are indeed watching it in a new way, and they're watching your programs and others in an activist way. Mm. That is, rather than sitting on the couch, people, as with the adoption film, are tweeting and saying, can I adopt this kid? And that, I think, I suppose, is new. I suppose some people before would write to the BBC or write to the filmmaker who knew who was and ask questions or even ask that kind of question, but it would be much more difficult and they would be kept at bay. Now, people assume an interactive conversation with you, in a way, or with your colleagues, and want their questions to be answered and want themselves to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
That, I guess, adds a dimension. It also adds some work.
Well, what it adds is a kind of confusion as well, because there'll be people who have their own access to ground, and they're much more able and capable of that. I mean, the access to compliance or the trust in governors and the Ofcom and all of the worries about this stuff have multiplied exponentially. I mean, really, it's huge now, and it's very worrying because, I mean, A, we might get something wrong, and obviously we try hard not to, but the accusation, I mean, there's a Primark on Panorama on Primark that won all sorts of awards 2 years ago and is a brilliant film. And Primark went to Bangladesh and said, or wherever it was, Sri Lanka, and said, you know, the BBC paid people to lie about their working conditions. And then the witnesses called the BBC and said, look, if you pay us more, we'll say we didn't lie. But Ofcom, which threw out the complaint, they complained again to the governors of the BBC, whatever it's called, the Trust, BBC Trust. And the Trust is reinvestigating 2 years later a film that, you know, by most journalistic standards was brilliant and very thoughtful and well-made, blah, blah, blah. And the amount of editorial time taken to deal with this, what I regard as spurious complaint, but I mean, I wasn't there, and is serious, and it's a terrible drag. I mean, I don't know how many of you ever know the word entropy in English, but it's a very good word for describing this. It's really about a drag in the system. You know, it just uses up energy for no purpose at all. And so that's, I mean, the interactivity has its downside.
Fourth law of thermodynamics.
Exactly.
Everything loves Darren.
That's right, actually, yes.
Thank you. I'll give you a call later.